This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, a telltale Dakota folk life and stories about polio. But we are going to start today with legacy. Tim Gallego was a Lakota journalist, author, publisher, veteran, entrepreneur, and activist. He passed away last week at 88. He left behind quite a legacy, an inspiration for Indigenous journalists. Alicia Haglund-Thorpe shares a remembrance.
Tim Gallego's Lakota name was He Stands Up For Them, or Defender, a perfect name for a journalist. He was Oglala Lakota, born in Kyle, South Dakota, on the Pine Ridge Reservation. It was there he started the first independently owned, non-tribally affiliated Native American newspaper in America. Many Native journalists call him one of the most influential leaders amongst our people. Doris Gallego, his ex-wife and longtime partner in the newspaper business, says he was one of the leading voices in Indian country. He fought for freedom of expression for years. Our newspaper was attacked, firebombed, but threats didn't stop him. Gallego was indeed a trailblazer. For more than three decades, he campaigned against the use of Native American nicknames, logos, and symbols by college and professional sports teams, which led to an appearance on the Oprah Winfrey Show in 1992.
Mount Rushmore may be a shrine of democracy to most Americans, but it is a shrine of hypocrisy to his people. He says that the four giant white faces on sacred Indian land shows that the government disrespects Native Americans. Tim Gallego is the publisher of the Lakota Times. It is the nation's largest Native American newspaper. We're glad you can join our discussion. So what I wanted to have you to explain is the same thing I was asking Suzanne to explain to Mike and to the rest of the country, why it is not a small issue, the mascots.
Well, I think when you take a race of people and you name a football team after the color of their skins, when you take what are to us are religious artifacts like pipes and eagle feathers, which are given in a sacred way, we paint our faces in a sacred way, then you're defiling our religion as well as our color and our race. So I think you need to be sensitive to the fact that we do have a very old and very deep spirituality, and we hate to see that defiled also.
Right. I love what you said in the article, because it would be as if the during halftime the teams put on Afro wigs and painted their faces black and jumped around and did whatever they thought was stereotypical of black people, we would all be crazed. We'd be outraged.
Oprah, I think probably one of the classic examples during the Super Bowl was they took a pig and painted it red and put what we call a ceremonial bonnet, which you call a war bonnet, mm-hmm. on the pig's head. And the analogy I made in an article I wrote after that is, what if you took the pig and painted it black and put an Afro wig on it?
Uh-huh.
I mean, there would be a clamor in the United States that would be heard all over the world. As a newspaper man, I've been in this business for 20 years, and the fact that you have us on the show to talk about things that are important to us, the complexities in Indian country are tremendous, and to do it in one show in an hour, it's an impossibility. At least we're able to touch on a few little things that are important to us, and we appreciate that very much.
Gallego's efforts helped pave the way for renaming Columbus Day in South Dakota to Native American Day. In 1990, South Dakota Governor George Mickelson, inspired by Gallego's words, asked the legislature to seek reconciliation between whites and Native Americans 100 years after the massacre of Wounded Knee. The legislature passed the law unanimously, making it the first state to change the holiday. It was in the Navy at the time of the Korean War that Gallego got his start by writing for the Base newspaper. But in 1979, he became the first Native American writer for a South Dakota newspaper when he was hired by the Rapid City Journal as a columnist. Jim Carrier was the paper's editor. He said this of Gallego: "For the first time, Indians were reading about themselves. He provided a portrait of Native Americans with families, traditions, struggles, sports, children, elders, religion, etc. Not many months later, I persuaded him to become a full-time reporter covering the Pennington County Commission. He wanted to cover Indian news. I refused, arguing that he could not be objective. Several times, Tim would storm into the newsroom after witnessing the racist attitudes of the white commissioners and quit. I would follow him out onto the fire escape and talk him into staying." In 1981, Tim and his wife Doris took out a small loan, bought a typesetter, and began publishing the first independent Indian newspaper in the country, working out of a former beauty shop in Pine Ridge. That publication was called the Lakota Times. And in 1992, he changed the paper's name to Indian Country Today to reflect its national coverage. He sold the paper in 1998 to the Oneida Nation in New York with the lure of retirement around the corner. But not long after, he founded the Lakota Journal and most recently, Native Sun News. Gallego was also a columnist for several other publications, including the Huffington Post. In 1983, Gallego co-founded the Native American Journalists Association and served as its first president. In 1991, he was awarded a Nieman Fellowship from Harvard University. In 1994, he was inducted to the South Dakota Hall of Fame. And in 2007, he was the first Native American inducted into the South Dakota Newspaper Hall of Fame. Here's Gallego with Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson from April 20th, 2012.
Was there a special challenge to covering Native issues and in Indian country?
Well, it's very, very challenging. One of the things we discovered right away is that attending council meetings, sometimes they would close the door and go into executive session simply because there was a reporter there. I recall going to Aberdeen, South Dakota, to the Bureau of Indian Affairs meeting that was going to take place because of a business that the BIA was going to help start on Pine Ridge and Fort Berthold, coaling factory. And they were having this meeting. Well, we had done some investigative reporting, background investigating, and found out that the character that was selling this coaling factory was a very not-to-be-trusted person. I mean, he had a very bad record. But the BIA was still willing to pony up $19 million to start this business. So I came into the Bureau of Indian Affairs office. Everybody from Fort Berthold and Pine Ridge was all sitting around. I walked in with a camera and a notebook. They adjourned the meeting and moved it to a private hotel rather than have it on Bureau BIA grounds. So that's the kind of thing you run into. You're dealing with a bureaucracy. Any reporter can tell you it's probably one of the hardest subjects to get any information. But I think our challenge in trying to get news from Indian agencies and Indian reservations is probably a little more difficult than the mainstream.
Why do you think that is?
I think the answer is really very simple. Tribes have been maligned so long for so many years by the mainstream media that they have a dreaded suspicion of the media. And so many of the things that they have done in a good way has failed to make the media and newspapers. And a lot of the good things are just pushed aside, and a lot of the bad things come out in the front in the papers. And I think the tribes and the tribal people, the tribal leaders just got tired of that. So I know we had a very difficult time when we started on Pine Ridge. You know? We were the first independent weekly newspaper that was Indian-owned and Indian-operated. All of the papers like Navajo Times, which had been around since 1967, were good, solid newspapers, but they were owned by the tribe. Almost all of the papers that were operating at the time in the United States were tribally owned, and so therefore very limited in what they could do in the way of coverage of the tribe.
Do you think that there is a trust issue and that you're slowly breaking down this trust issue?
I think a lot of the tribal leaders know that we're going to try to do a fair job. We're going to try to hear both sides of an issue. I think that's given us a foot in the door that probably the mainstream media doesn't have.
What I understand now is that you're doing more commentaries, editorials, and less reporting. What's the challenge for an editorial writer?
Well, there's so many topics out there that you want to touch on. You know, we've got elections coming up on the reservation, and we want to touch on them. There's a national election coming on, and that's very important to the tribes because so many decisions made in Washington come back down and impact on us out here. We've got a lot of issues to deal with in the way of alcoholism, drug abuse, probably substandard schools. We aren't having enough kids graduate. We have too many dropouts. We have a whole issue when it comes to health. We probably have an average lifespan on Pine Ridge of about mid-50s, which is terrible in this day and age when the average lifespan of most Americans is going up, way up into the late 70s. And so we have all these issues that we try our best to cover and keep the people informed. And knowledge, I think, creates intelligence.
What do you think the future of the tribes are and Native Americans in the current scheme of things in the United States?
Well, I think the tribes right now have come a long way in that they have, for the first time in a lot of years, their own attorneys. They have a lot of good legal minds. They have a lot of educated people that are trying to move the tribes to accept and really believe in their own sovereignty. And I don't see any government coming along in Washington that is going to put us through all of the things they put us through over the last 100 years, from termination to whatever. And I think there's a lot of ignorance out there, too, that so many people, non-Indian people, don't really know a lot of the things that the experiments, I would say, that were performed on the tribes. We were like the miner's canary when an attorney said he put us in the mine to see if we dropped dead. And if we drop dead, there's something wrong with that idea or that experiment. So from day one, when the educational system was set up to assimilate more than educate, it caused a lot of damage that I think we're still feeling the impact of the boarding schools. As a matter of fact, one of my good friends, Floyd Resterman, call him Red Crow, he went on to be a good actor, a famous actor with a television series, but he never forgot to his dying day of how he felt when he was put on a bus and sent off to boarding school. And he said he looked out of the window and he saw his mother turn away, and he thought, well, she's walking away because she doesn't want me anymore. And when she turned around, she was crying. And he said all those women that were putting their kids on the bus were crying. So he, after more than 60 years on this earth, he still felt the pain of having taken from his parents and put into a boarding school, and to go through all of the acculturation, assimilation things that took place in those schools, destruction of traditions, culture, language, spirituality. These are still things that are impacting this generation of Native Americans simply because it's come through the different generations, their fathers, their grandfathers. And a lot of that has to do also with stuff I've written. I wrote a book called Children Left Behind, which dealt primarily with abuse of children in boarding schools, including sexual abuse. And so we see that coming full circle also. I mean, some of the parents and grandparents were abused. What do they become after they get out of school when they were abused as a child? In a lot of cases, they become the abusers. So that was not a part of our culture. It never was. And so with that being pounded into the heads of innocent children for generations, it impacts everything that is happening today. And a lot of educators, I think, need to understand that. They see problems within their school systems, among their students. They need to look back and see where that started. And they're not, a lot of the young teachers today are good, but they don't know their own history. And they need to learn where we've been in order to find out where we're going.
What do you think about Indian newspapers, also just journalism in general?
Well, I think if you go to other parts of the country, Cherokee, they have the Cherokee Phoenix, which is still extremely popular. Navajo Nation's paper is just absolutely a strong and beautiful paper yet. People read it. They read it because it's their paper. I think Native American students should not be afraid to pursue a career in journalism right now, because there's still going to be opportunities coming, whether it be in the print word or on radio, television, or starting their own blogs or their own newspaper on the Internet. I mean, there's so many opportunities yet. The one thing I worry about is they had an American Indian High School media program, and what I see happening there is the instructors are primarily from the white media. And they feel that they need to push those kids into the white media rather than telling them, get a start on your tribal newspaper, get a start at an independent Indian newspaper, learn your craft, and then you'll be ready to move into a larger part of the media. Because, as newspaper editors and publishers on all of the Indian papers in the country, we need our own professional journalists, so we hate to see them push past us.
Over his four-decade career, Gallego wrote several books and columns and earned several awards. His first book was published in 1978, a book of poems called The Aboriginal Sin, which shared reflections about his education and experience at the Holy Rosary Indian Mission in Pine Ridge, which is also known as the Red Cloud Indian School. In 1984 and 1999, he published two volumes of newspaper columns called Notes from Indian Country. In 1999, he wrote a book titled The American Indian and the Media. And in 2006, he returned to the topic of his Indian school experience, writing a highly controversial book called Children Left Behind, The Dark Legacy of Indian Mission Boarding Schools. The book recounted the abusive conditions at the Holy Rosary Indian Mission, which was run by the Roman Catholic Church. In 1985, Gallego earned the H.L. Mencken Award for Journalism, but he returned the award after finding out that Mencken had written articles and a diary that exemplified racism. He was also awarded a Distinguished Journalism Award from the University of Missouri. In a column he wrote for his 87th birthday in July 2021, Gallego reflected on his life and career, writing, "It's been a grand ride for the 41 years I published my newspapers, and a grander ride for the 87 years that have brought me to this point in my life. I have met many good people, made many good friends, and I'm sure made a few enemies along that bumpy road." As a Lakota journalist, author, publisher, veteran, entrepreneur, and activist, Tim Gallego has left an inspiring legacy for young Indigenous journalists as he gave voice to the country's first people. May his wit, strength, and legacy live on in the institutions he built and the lives he touched.
That was a remembrance of the late Tim Gallego, the Lakota journalist who passed away last week at 88. Produced by Alicia Heglin-Thorpe, one of the very journalists that Gallego inspired. And speaking of inspiration and inspiring people, we're going to talk now about Lydia Sage Chase. She was inducted last September into the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. Today, we hear from several people whose lives she touched. Dawn Charging, Lydia's adopted sister and a former member of the North Dakota House of Representatives. We also hear from Eric Holland, curator of education at the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Iona Little White Man, a former bookstore manager and student at Nueta Hidatsa Sanish College. Doug Purchill, former director of North Dakota State Parks. Matt Shenandoah, enrolled member of the MHA Nation and assistant manager at Fort Abraham Lincoln State Park. Dr. Carrie Hartman, dean and department chair, Nueta Hidatsa Sanish College. Betty Lockwood, director of adult education at Nueta Hidatsa Sanish College. Lydia herself. And finally, we hear from Kevin Kramer.
I remember Lydia every day. She was the spirit of our culture. She lived it. She believed in it. She prayed. She brought so many people together and mentored people. She was amazing.
She was concerned about the cultural traditions that were being lost and recognized that if she didn't get involved in the culture, it would be gone. She gained knowledge and gave knowledge at the same time to be able to help others understand that this isn't primitive, this isn't unsophisticated, it's just different. It's an other, and it was her other.
Lydia, she was really into culture and, you know, about preserving, yes, what you talked about, you know, culture preservation. She really was. And it was more or less like our language, the Hidatsa language. You know, if we lose that, then, you know, like, who are we now?
We're sitting in reconstructed Earth Lodge on a slant village, Fort Abraham Lincoln. Lydia Sage Chase was involved with the interpretive component, educating people on the life of the Mandan in this village. This village was built by the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 30s. Lydia's great-grandmother, Scattered Corn, was an advisor to them. So Lydia, 50 years later, comes to work in the village. But not only did she do the interpretive education, she outfitted these lodges so people who visited could see how the Mandan lived.
Lydia Sage Chase was very instrumental in really starting the interpretation of the Mandans living at the Onislam village, the same interpretation we have today that has grown exponentially over the last decades.
That program that she developed while she was here exists today. the things that are in the lodges, additional lodges built, is a tribute to the work she did.
Visitors come to visit Honest Land even in the past, over the past 30 years, as we had Lydia here, as my grandmother Regina was here, and even myself. We're all descendants of that Mandan culture. And so having that one-on-one connection with a descendant of the people that once lived at Honest Land really brings in that deep connection to our visitors.
Lydia's ability to communicate about her traditions was a piece of her personal character that she saw that that language and culture was diminishing and was very concerned, so went into the school systems and taught.
Lydia had a great talent and probably a natural-born empathy for her students and great concern. But I remember her just being very, very one-on-one and deeply involved with each student she was working with.
I was a student at one time, and actually I came here 40 days after my brother died. And Lydia and Bob, like, helped me actually kind of get through that, actually. If it wasn't for her, I think, I don't know.
Once we can get the students through whatever life dealt them or they're up against, that they're capable of doing it. And Lydia did a really good job at encouraging those students to come through.
She was watching, and she cared. And she would wheel up to their door, literally, and knock on the door and say, "How come you're not in class? You got to get this degree. This is the beginning for you."
One year, Lydia Sage Chase had a graduation rate. She had 75 students, and that was the highest ever with the college.
There's a lot of Native American people that are multi-talented people and who just haven't had the time or opportunity to show their abilities. And I think this is the place that's going to help our people be able to do such a thing.
Lydia had a superpower, a spiritual, ceremonial power that none of us can describe. And she saw things in people. I am thankful to have been one of those that she selected. She saw something in me and helped me to find it. But I wasn't the only one. Kevin Kramer, he's another. Former Governor Ed Schaefer, he is yet another. Prior to either of them in their leadership roles, she came to them. And she became a part of all of our lives, and she pulled all of us together and mentored us in ways that is kind of indescribable.
Lydia was a highly skilled educator and cultural interpreter who helped give countless people, including maybe especially me, a greater appreciation for the heritage of all Native Americans on the Upper Missouri. In her dignified and unassuming manner, Lydia demonstrated to all who were fortunate enough to be her students the importance of preserving customs, language, and traditions.
One of the most amazing things about Lydia was her husband, Bob. The two of them did everything together, from her earlier years with the parks, and Bob was so faithful and so unbelievably supportive of her.
Lydia Sage Chase's legacy is recounted on a daily basis out here. And the shining example of a statement that we have here in our visitor center, which echoes that the Mandans, even though they are not here, their spirits remain right along the banks of the Heart and Missouri Rivers.
The Lydia Sage Chase legacy in life is that here we are all these years later after her departure on this earth, and we're here today. We're talking about her. We're carrying on her spirit. We're carrying on her beliefs and her dreams.
The That audio comes from a video produced by Mokoche Studios in Bismarck. All of the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor profiles are on Mokoche's Vimeo page. We'll share a link to that on the Main Street page at prairiepublic.org. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota medical facilities continue to face a turbulent staffing situation, especially when it comes to hiring and retaining traveling nurses. Prairie Public's Nick Rommel has the story.
Earlier this summer, Sanford Hospitals in Fargo cut traveling nurses' pay rates by up to 60%. The move came as part of a nationwide trend, says Sanford VP of Nursing Teresa Larson.
As we looked at the demand going down, we knew that nationwide that is what was happening. And so we just, you know, followed suit in knowing that we could reduce those rates and kind of get back in alignment with where we need to be, which is what we're working on right now.
The drop in demand for traveling nurses comes as the COVID pandemic eases its grip on North Dakota hospitals. The pandemic had caused such a demand for nursing staff that traveling nurses were being paid upwards of $100 an hour in North Dakota hospitals. Tessa Johnson, president of the North Dakota Nurses Association and executive director of a long-term care facility in Dickinson, says that these kind of pay rates were unsustainable for medical facilities across the state.
Yeah, it's catastrophic, really, because, I mean, I'm already aware of two very small town long-term care facilities in our area that have closed down partly because of this, because you just can't afford it. That's, you know, that's one of the things as a long-term care administrator that I am harping on and working with my staff every single day, that, you know, we have to find a way to decrease agency and to think outside the box and have management pick up more shifts.
While Sanford's pay cut may be seen as a sign of better times to come for hospitals, Johnson says that COVID numbers are increasing again and that her facility is as vigilant as ever, and staffing issues remain regardless. According to a Sanford traveling nurse who wished to remain anonymous, the pay cut led to many resignations and a change in strategy from Sanford.
And what that led to was several travelers leaving that had been there, some of them for months and some just for one contract, but they left, which in turn left us short for a while and then created a need to fill those holes again. They weren't getting people applying fast enough or enough, so then they raised the rates online to more than what they cut us to.
Steps taken to combat the issue include a failed bill by the North Dakota Nurses Association to create an in-state travel nurse agency, as well as a bill recently proposed by Senator Kevin Cramer that would require the Government Accountability Office to investigate the business practices of traveling nurse hiring agencies, who are the middlemen between hospitals and nurses. But for now, medical facilities remain reliant on travelers, even as the pandemic quiets down. For Prairie Public, I'm Nick Rommel.
And I'm Danielle Webster. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is August now. Time to talk about, you know, the really long, hot days of summer and the impacts on our gardens. I am joined now by horticulturist Ron Smith. Ron, thanks for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ashley. Thank you. I hope
you're having a lovely summer.
Yes, a hot, lovely summer.
Yes.
It has its impact on everything, your mood, your schedule for going ahead and working outside.
Yes, more heat,
get it done in the morning before it
me.
Gets too hot.
Yeah.
And never too warm for you, you say,
yeah,
right now.
Pretty
okay.
much.
Then you ought to be the happiest one in the flock.
I am. Summer is my jam.
Anyhow, it's been good, but one of the things I want to talk about here very briefly, so I don't forget it, is the upcoming display garden event August 9th from 3 to 7 p.m. out at the Horticulture Research and Demonstration Gardens.
This is by NDSU?
Right there, okay. By NDSU, yes. It's on 18th Street and 12th Avenue North in Fargo.
Okay.
And so there's lectures there on bedding plants. There's lectures there on turf grass care, lectures there on how to get through the rest of the summer horticulturally. And so I really recommend that quite highly. It's a very good educational place to facility, I should say, to mm-hmm. learn a lot of things. That
and you get to hang outside yeah. plants.
Yep,
plants you and people who know how to hang out, how yeah. to deal with them.
yeah, absolutely. The other thing I want to kind of mention is that there's been a lot of concern about what some people have said. They see their plants wilting, even though the soil is moist. Hmm. And my wife has been one of those people. And it's what it is. It's what's called midday wilt. And it's called midday wilt because when the sun goes down, or not doesn't have to go down, but when we get into the cooler part of the day, late afternoon, early evening, the leaves recover. And that typically shows up on squash and pumpkin leaves and mm-hmm. on tomato.
So the high heat, they sort of droop.
They try to save moisture as much as they mm-hmm. can. They don't want to dehydrate yeah. themselves.
This is why Spanish people take a siesta, because it's too hot.
Yes, yes.
And then you come back and
yeah, and so they now we can yeah. go ahead and carry on our normal transpirational activity.
Okay.
The other thing, too, is that I've seen some chlorotic trees, trees showing some yellow leaves that don't have a right to, really, because they've been planted there for several years.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what's happened is that the deficiency of iron availability has shown up. I haven't gone up and knocked on people's doors or anything like that. But it's iron deficiency showing up usually that causes the trees to lose their chlorophyll. And it's a step towards the decline and the eventual death of that tree.
Hmm.
If they can catch it early enough and get some chelated iron inserted into the tree or around the base of the tree through fertilization, it could be saved. If it's all yellow, it's ready to become firewood. So,
and is this hitting a specific kind of tree typically, well, or is it
well,
pretty
the maples,
widespread?
The seedling maples are typically the ones that show that kind of a problem. But I've
okay.
seen them showing up on a beautiful river birch in my neighborhood,
yeah.
a big, beautiful river birch that I was envious of.
Yeah.
And it's a goner. It's gone too far.
Oh, no.
And so I'm sorry to see that go because it's an absolutely beautiful tree.
So when you say too far gone, are you talking like less than a quarter of the leaves and it could still be saved or
well, if you,
less than
yeah,
that even?
The thing is, it's like checking your kids, you know, how do you feel today?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you eat your breakfast and mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. So you get into kind of observing your plants and how it's growing and what you see showing up there that you like and you don't like. And then be aware that there might be some things there to be concerned with. Lots of times if you see one or two leaves turning yellow, that's just normal. That's like losing hair, a few hairs out of your head. But if you see handfuls of hair coming out of your head, that's something to be concerned about.
Okay.
It's the same thing with leaves turning yellow, losing chlorophyll, and you get more and more of it. And I don't want to give you a 25% or 30% or 40% or 50% because
okay.
it just seems that once it gets going, it kind of progresses and progresses, and suddenly the homeowner looks out, says, my gosh, this tree has bright yellow leaves. It's not supposed to. It hasn't had that in 25, 30, or 40 years. Why is it doing it now? And so it's too late at that point to get it to be resurrected. So you're just better off to get it out and replant as quickly as you can.
Okay.
If you have weeds, broadleaf weeds in your yard, on your lawn, this is a good time to go ahead and get them under control because they are in an assimilative type of growth. Most of them are. And they will take in that herbicide that you're going to be applying and hopefully kill the whole thing. Not just the top part of the plant, but the crown and the root system and the rhizome as well. So that's just a good time to do it. Another good thing to keep in mind, look out for Japanese beetles. They're a very attractive beetle. If you see a couple of Japanese beetles on your plants,
call someone immediately.
Yeah. Put them in some soapy warm water.
Okay.
And that'll take care of them. Just sweep them off. Don't go ahead and start spraying insecticide or anything like that. You just knock them off the plant. They're mm-hmm. kind of they act like they're half drunk and half awake.
But they haven't shown up in North Dakota yet, have they?
I haven't seen any yet, and I haven't heard anybody complaining about it yet.
Okay.
But they are in Minnesota. And what is in Minnesota
will
gradually works its way towards North Dakota.
Okay.
Now, as soon as I say that, there might be somebody out there and say, tell Ron Smith I've got Japanese beetles in my garden, you know.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and they are particularly dangerous to have because they eat.
They have a teenager's appetite,
yeah,
as adults.
Okay.
And then the larvae or the grub that you see, mm-hmm, gets stuck in the soil around the root system, and they go after the roots of the grass plants, mm-hmm, and other ornamental plants.
Okay.
But their grass plant is their favorite thing to go, okay, after.
Am I correct in thinking that if you do see a Japanese beetle, you need to be reaching out to, like, your county extension agent or something?
Absolutely,
right? Definitely,
yes.
Report,
yeah,
this.
Let them know. Okay. Yeah, and let them know that that's something's going on over here. And,
okay.
Even if you're not sure it's a Japanese beetle,
yeah,
just let them know anyway.
Do we know how far west in Minnesota they have gotten?
Not this year, but I've, okay, heard that they've been in our adjacent county, Clay County,
oh,
in the past. Yes.
Okay. Well, that borders Cass County in North Dakota.
Yeah,
so
they don't have to go far to get into us.
Okay.
So finally, fall is a good time. Late August, early September is a good time to get some plantings done, ornamental trees and shrubs, woody plants. Get the planting done, because it will be perfect for getting the root system established. You're not going to put on any new growth at this time. You don't have to worry about the leaves wilting. You don't, mm-hmm, have to worry about sensitivity to herbicides being sprayed in the area, because people aren't doing it for the most part, and the leaves that you have there now are beginning to go through senescence, drying up, dying, dropping off,
okay,
losing their chlorophyll. So it's a natural cycle to go ahead and coordinate with your planting efforts, because that root system is going to be actively growing as long as the soil is above 40 degrees. The soil temperature is about, mm-hmm, 40 degrees. So you're going to get some growth taking place here. And so I advise taking advantage of that.
Okay. Now, we did get a couple of questions, Ron. Marie in Fargo wants to know why she isn't getting any raspberries this year. And she's heard from other people who normally are getting a lot of raspberries. Is this just a bad year for raspberries?
Yeah, there's an insect out there, and I can't think of the name of it right now. But she probably has that bug. I know I'll think of it after we get done recording. I would say that's probably the number one thing that I would be concerned, mm-hmm, about. The other thing is that she might not be pruning them properly, because there's a flora cane and then there's a productive cane. So she might just be seeing the new canes coming out and not bearing any fruit. If she gets the canes bearing fruit from the older cane and fruit-bearing canes, they'll be productive. And then once they're done producing, then you go ahead and cut them out.
Okay.
So
going back to the possible pest, if it is a bug, what are there other telltale signs besides no raspberries? Are we looking at leaves?
Well, if there are raspberries there, excuse me, you're going to see this little insect out there. Why there would be no fruit at all, I just can't figure, because raspberries in North Dakota grow like weeds.
Yeah.
I mean, everywhere I've ever planted them or seen them planted, they were great for a few years, but after a while they just overcame me, kind of, mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm, mint does, mm-hmm, in your garden.
I dug up a lot of lemon balm this year that started out its,
yeah,
life, you,
yep,
know, 3 years ago at 3 inches tall and is, yeah, now 3 feet,
yeah,
tall.
You're,
and,
yeah, now you're wrestling with them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah, those mint families. We also have a question about clover, and a listener who is considering swapping out the grass on the boulevard or the berm and wondering about planting clover. And is that the kind of thing you want, just clover? Do you want to do a clover and grass seed mix? What are some advantages and disadvantages here?
A little bit of history. When I was a teenager working at a local garden center and learning all about this stuff, clover was part of a seed mix, and so it had Kentucky Blue, perennial rye, fescue, and some clover.
Mm.
And this is before the days of everybody having an irrigation system or being conscientious about watering, okay, their lawn. And so if you put this down and your lawn grew, but you had a drought period, the grass would turn brown,
mm-hmm,
be dormant. The doggone clover would still be green and producing these little white flowers. And that's the white Dutch clover,
okay,
which is, I'm 100% sure, that's what they're probably putting into the seed mixes now, if they have it. If you don't, they don't have any now. If you want to just go ahead and put straight clover down, it's not going to be a uniform coverage like you get in your turf grass.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have spotty greens showing up. And if that's acceptable to you, that's fine. That'll be good for the pollinators. The bees love it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a little white Dutch flower.
Yeah.
They'll be busy as bees getting after the pollen and the nectar that's in that. That in fact, as kids, we used to pick the flowers, and if there weren't any bees on it, you could eat the clover. You know, I mean,
nice, yeah.
And I'm still alive.
Well,
at 85.
I think you can make a tea with it too.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're not spraying your lawn at all. Am I also correct in remembering there is like a purple clover or a reddish one too?
Yeah, there is. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to draw a blank on it. You're right. Mm-hmm. It's somewhere in the recesses of my mind. Yes, there is a purplish one.
Okay.
But it's too far back in the distant memory to say what it is for sure.
Now, I don't know that I've ever really just noticed clover seeds for sale. Are those fairly available at a big box or a small nursery?
I would say probably not at this point. But
okay.
If the interest in considering the pollinators of our society,
mm-hmm.
the native bees and the introduced honeybees, yeah. which would be after them as well,
mm-hmm.
plus any number of other insects.
Yeah, do the monarchs like them? Because they're now on the endangered species list.
Yes, okay. Of course, yeah. But I would say if that continues to grow, you're going to maybe be able to get it through, you know, mail order or catalog sources to go ahead and put
online.
It in there. And if they do start showing it up, locally, it'll be like a local hardware store where they have a seed bulk, clover seed,
mm-hmm.
Kentucky bluegrass seed, perennial ryegrass seed, so on and so forth.
Okay. Yeah, what I did for my boulevard was I bought a type of grass that is called a no-mow grass, and it mm-hmm. grows up 3 or 4 inches
mm-hmm.
and then just kind of lays flat like
mm-hmm.
a little
fairy. Yeah, that's fine.
Kind of
yeah,
thing.
I grew that.
And then
nice.
I mixed in some white Dutch clover with mine. And
yeah.
yes, it very much, like, I thought that I had distributed the clover seeds pretty evenly, but they are definitely, it's patchy. And,
that's okay.
You, know, that's
you don't have to have everything
like,
uniform
so.
And
yeah.
the hand of a human being has been
right,
there.
Right.
Nature
take its
course.
That way. All right. We check in with horticulturist Ron Smith periodically during the growing season. Thank you so much for your time today, Ron.
It's been a pleasure to be here and see you again.
We'll have a telltale Dakota folk life and stories after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Otto Bremer Trust, investing in people, places, and opportunities in North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Learn more at ottobremer.org.
And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant at the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck, naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. There's no shortage of disease in the news, but here's one we haven't heard about for a while, polio. It's from an episode of Telltale, Dakota Folk Life and Stories. This is a collection of narratives describing the shared personal experiences and lore of life on the North Dakota Plains. These oral histories feature senior citizens, many of whom are in elder care facilities. Today, our story on polio is gathered at Maryhill Manor in Enderlin. Here's narrator David Swenson.
There was no disease that fostered fear in North Dakotans in the first half of the 20th century as much as polio did. Thousands of children and adults were crippled by polio. Dennis contracted polio when he was 14 years old. He woke up one night with
terrific pain in my back and legs and so on. And, of course, we had a doctor by the name of Dr. Batchelor in Enderlin here. And you gave him a call, and you didn't care what time of day or night he was there. And he came and he looked at me, and he told his folks, we're going to load him up and take him to Fargo. He knew what was going on. Huh. Next day, they done a final tap, and then they determined that it was polio.
He was transported to Fargo, and taken to St. John's Hospital.
There was so many of us that one West and Old St. John's Hospital was all polio patients. Bottom floor on the West End, they called it One West. There had to be 30, 35 of us in there. And they had two young nurses that had just got out of nursing school. And that was their first job. And they would go around. The only thing they knew what to do then, they had an old washing machine. It had a wringer on it, and they put a heating unit inside of it, and they heated the water up and put these wool rags in there and wrapped our legs in that. And then we had one physiotherapist that worked with us. There was one little boy who was 4 years old that had it.
Oh, my.
And then it went up to, I think, some of the fellows were in their late 20s already.
Oh, there was people in just about any walk of life that got polio. It's a very devastating disease.
Nearly everyone remembered a friend or a relative who suffered from the effects of polio.
Well, at first, you couldn't stand up or anything. You had no use of your legs at all.
Yeah, and I think it's a pain, like my uncle was. It affected his back quite a bit.
Yeah, there was different versions of it.
Yeah, when he was about 12, 13 years old, he and his brother both had it. His back had an S on his spine.
I had a brother that had polio, and he ended up in Minneapolis at the Gillette Hospital. He went in September, and he came home in spring, and he couldn't walk. He got out of the hospital, and he came home, but he couldn't really do anything. And most of the time, he sat in a chair, and if he wanted to go someplace, he got on his hands and knees and crawled.
This was a time before widespread health insurance. Friends and neighbors helped each other in times of need.
The family had to take care of it. And of course, we didn't have very much money. We just ended up taking care of the boy.
It wasn't only individuals, it was many people. Helping with the bills was a lot, because that costs money. And I think they were always satisfied with what they got, because they got a lot.
The cost of treatment could be devastating.
At the time, we had Dad just had a small farm, too, and there was no insurance at that time and stuff. That's where the March of Dimes originated, and in 5 months, the hospital bill was $5,000, and the March of Dimes paid that. I'm sure Dad would have lost the farm.
The March of Dimes, founded by President Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1938, contributed millions of dollars to research. And in 1954, a vaccine was ready for testing. Approximately 1,700 grade school children in North Dakota, called polio pioneers, were given the test vaccine. The effectiveness of the vaccine was responsible for a 90% drop in polio cases. By 1964, new cases were nearly non-existent. Produced in partnership with Maryhill Manor in Enderlin, North Dakota, and Dakota Legacy. This project is supported in part by a grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts, which receives funding from the North Dakota State Legislature and the National Endowment for the Arts.
Narrator David Swenson owns Mokoche Studios in Bismarck, where Telltale is produced. Dakota Daybook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for August 2nd. In our state, as everywhere, there are internationalists who believe that the U.S. should be deeply involved in foreign affairs and isolationists who do not believe the U.S. should be heavily involved with nations that don't want anyone telling them what to do. In the 1930s, the prevailing mood was isolationist, that the U.S. should not intervene as the winds of war swept over Europe and Asia. North Dakota Senator Gerald P. Nye was an important leader of the congressional isolationists, believing the U.S. had made a major mistake by involving itself in World War I and vowing the U.S. should stay out of the war between Germany and Great Britain, which began September 3, 1939. The U.S. was officially neutral, but President Franklin Roosevelt was openly anti-German from the start. FDR's administration pushed selective service legislation through Congress by September 1940. It was the first ever U.S. peacetime draft. Senator Nye condemned peacetime conscription as, quote, a direct contribution to the creation of a dictatorship, unquote, for FDR. With legislation called Lend-Lease, Roosevelt all but emptied U.S. military supply depots to provide war goods for Britain after June 1940 and the fall of France to the Nazis. Senator Nye said it should be labeled as a go-to-war bill rather than Lend-Lease, calling it a brazen act of power-grabbing by Roosevelt, that it granted him powers beyond any, quote, ever granted to a president even when our country was at war, unquote, bringing forth a presidential dictatorship. Senator Nye accused FDR of spreading propaganda for war through his speeches and his actions. According to Nye, this propaganda included Hollywood films and newsreels. It was on this date in 1941 that the senator accused movie makers of promoting war hysteria by making movies such as Sergeant York, The Great Dictator, Convoy, and I Married a Nazi. He felt the films helped whip Americans into a frenzy for involvement in the war. He contended that the British had been trying to, quote, ensnare the United States into active participation in Britain's side since 1939. Nye's criticism of FDR persisted right up to December 7, 1941, when the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, thrust the nation into World War II. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Professor Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. Join me Wednesday for Morning Edition on Prairie Public. NPR will bring you news from the nation and the world, and I'll have the latest stories from North Dakota and the Prairie region, along with the day's weather. Listen beginning at 4 a.m. Central on member-supported Prairie Public, telling North Dakota and the region's stories.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, the legacy of the State Bank of North Dakota and its impacts on small town banks and the small towns themselves. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.